This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, how the crisis in Yemen, which has many local political roots, reflects the growing Sunni-Shia divide in the region and magnifies the power struggle between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Hello again, I'm Carol Castillo. Early on March 26th, Saudi Arabia started a military operation in neighboring Yemen to push back the Iranian-backed Houthi rebels who belong to the Zaydi sect, a subset of Shia Islam, and reinstate the legitimate government of President Abd Rabbo Mansour Hadi. The Houthi captured the capital Sana'a in September 2014 after weeks of anti-government protests centering on rising fuel prices and having rapidly taken over swaths of the country. The Saudi-led intervention, which consists of airstrikes supported by 10 countries, mainly Gulf states, as well as Jordan and Egypt, are the opening salvo in a campaign. The United States said it was providing logistical as well as intelligence support. Yemeni officials say Houthi rebels and their allies fought their way through the center of Aden Thursday and seized the presidential palace in the key southern port city. The rebels have been driving deeper into Aden in recent days while battling forces loyal to internationally backed President Abd Rabbo Mansour Hadi, who fled Aden last week. So are we witnessing a magnification of the Sunni-Shia divide and power struggle between Saudi Arabia and Iran? To what extent are primarily local grievances being used by powers to achieve geopolitical ends? And to what extent have nuclear talks with Iran provoked Saudi Arabia to act? An outline agreement on the future shape of Iran's nuclear program has been reached after marathon talks with six major powers in Switzerland. The European Union and Iran announced the deal after 8 days of negotiations in Lausanne. EU Foreign Policy Chief Federica Mogherini said Iran's enrichment capacity and stockpile would be limited. Mogherini said the agreement limits Iran's nuclear activity, so its Natanz location will be the only enrichment facility in the country. She said the deal also calls for the European Union and the United States to terminate all economic sanctions imposed on Iran once there is verification. A comprehensive nuclear accord is meant to be drafted by June 30th. Well, for more on the crisis in Yemen and to what extent it reflects a proxy war between Iran and Saudi Arabia, we turn to two distinguished analysts. Ambassador Barbara Bodine is a former U.S. ambassador to Yemen, now the director of the Institute for the Study of Diplomacy at Georgetown University here in Washington. Ambassador Bodine's 33-year Foreign Service career was spent primarily in the Middle East. And Graham Bannerman. He's a scholar at the Middle East Institute, that's a think tank here in Washington, and also founder of Bannerman Associates, an international consulting firm. He is a former staffer for Middle East and South Asia on the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee, as well as a former Middle East analyst at the U.S. Department of State's Policy Planning Staff. And both guests join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to you both.
Thank you very much.
Well, Ambassador Bodine, I'd like to begin with you to get your reaction to the Saudi airstrikes on Yemen to try to push back the Houthi rebels. What were the many factors, in your view, that led to the Saudis to start this campaign on Yemen with its many allies? And do you think this is an effective way to repel the Houthi and to try to reinstate President Hadi?
Let me take your questions kind of in reverse order. I do not think that this is a well-thought-through idea on the part of the Saudis. If they are trying to push the Houthi back from Aden, and at this point I think that's going to be very difficult, I don't think that they can do it. You can't do it, as we know quite well, you can't do these sorts of things with air power. And the Saudis really are not going to be putting major ground forces in Yemen. Even this idea that it's a broader Arab coalition, most of that support is political support, not military support. This is a Saudi operation. If the Saudis are trying to get the Houthi to the negotiating table, this is probably not the most effective way to do it. If they really want to push them back militarily, they're far too late. They waited until the Houthi were just on the outskirts of Aden. But I think there's a much more important question I'd like to touch on very briefly. To take this out of the context of a Sunni-Shia fight, whatever else the roots of the problems in Yemen and their local, domestic, economic, it's not Sunni-Shia, it's not even Zaydi-Shafi, if you want to get very precise about Yemen. Yes, the Houthi are Shia, but the central government was as well. Hadi is a southerner and therefore probably a Shafi, but none of this is really being driven by theology. There was a power vacuum. There was a governance vacuum. There was a complete lack of structure. And the Houthis were able to walk into this vacuum. Iran is a latecomer in terms of support to the Houthi. The Houthi rebellion's actually been going on since 2004. And to kind of go back to this sectarian divide, the insurgency was against the central government, and the central government was dominated by Zaydis. Iran came in late, and I think Iran did come in order to provoke the Saudis. But to think of the Houthi as Iranian sock puppets and to think of this in a Sunni-Shia divide really distorts the dynamics on the ground. And I think the Saudis have made that mistake.
Turning to you, Graham Bannerman, to get your take on the Saudi airstrikes and what they are meant to achieve. And, of course, we don't want to necessarily characterize what's going on in Yemen as some kind of a Sunni-Shia conflict. But what many analysts are saying and what it's obvious to observe is that you see the growing influence of Iran in its different proxies, whether in Lebanon and, of course, now in Iraq. Many of the Shia militias are pushing back against ISIL, the so-called Islamic State. And, of course, they're backing to the teeth Bashar al-Assad against the predominantly Sunni rebel opposition, those who are trying to defend themselves against Assad's onslaught. That said, we're not trying to necessarily characterize it as such, but we're looking at what's going on in Yemen. To some extent, what may be pushing Saudi Arabia is Iran's involvement in many of these areas. But let me get your take on the Saudi reaction, the airstrikes, you know, what led them to precipitate this campaign, and to what extent it can or cannot be effective.
Let me just begin by saying I agree with almost everything Barbara said, with one clarification. I look at it as a historian that the Zaydis were the government, the leaders of Yemen, from 897, that's 897, not 1897, until 2012. The agreement in 2012 put a Sunni leader in charge. That changed
Mansour Hadi.
Yes, Mansour Hadi, which changed the nature of the Houthi rebellion in the north, bringing in more Zaydis than were there. They could not have ever, as Houthis, conquered Sana'a. But there's also another factor in. Yemenis are nationalist. Mm-hmm. And therefore, this Yemeni nationalism also has come on board. And so therefore, many of the people who support this movement now are not Zaydis, but are also Sunnis, but they're Yemenis. In that context, when the Saudis intercede, that brings mm-hmm. them more together, put aside yeah. their tribal differences, their personal differences, to protect themselves against the Saudis, who are seen as the foreigners. One cannot forget, in the 1930s, there was a Yemeni-Saudi war in which the Yemenis lost three provinces, three governments in the north. Yemenis have not forgotten that. All of these things. And so there they see the Saudis as a threat. The thing the Saudis have done is they have transformed the discussion in the Middle East from being against Sunnis extremism, against ISIS, Al-Qaeda, as the primary threat, to being an Arab-Iranian threat. They have changed the entire debate within the region, not what's in the debate, but what the primacy of the debate is. That is what's happened with the Saudi intervention in Yemen. The other states have come in because they see the importance of their relationship with Saudi Arabia. I'm talking about countries like ourselves and the Egyptians and the Jordanians. They're supporting Saudi Arabia not because they necessarily agree with what they're doing in Yemen, but they need to support Saudi Arabia because they see Saudi Arabia as essential to their own security.
Well, Ambassador Bodine, if in fact, though, the Saudi airstrikes are mm-hmm. not going to bring the Houthi to the table,
right?
What is the United States thinking about this? I mean, we know that they provided some intelligence support, some kind of backing, but not, you know, military.
Right.
What's the U.S. position?
Well, I think to say that things in Yemen are complicated is an understatement. I would, again, sort of generally agree with my friend Graham, but I would say that when Hadi came in as the interim president, his roots in the South were more important than his Shafi Sunniism. And that was not the terms of the conversation in Yemen. Coming from the South, yes, but not religiously. To the extent that there has been a growing tension along sectarian lines in Yemen, it has been fueled, and this is probably what precipitated the Houthi rebellion in the first place, precipitated by a growing influence of Salafist in Yemen, not Sunnis per se, not the indigenous Shafis in the south, but by Saudi-influenced Salafis. And so to the extent that there is a sectarian fight going on, it was in many ways precipitated by Saudi influence on one side with the Houthi responding to it. Why are we involved? A couple of things. One is to support Saudi Arabia, who is very important to us in the region. Two, the Houthi, it was a coup, and we do not wish to support a change in a democratically selected popular government, relatively popular government, by force. And so when the Saudis made the decision, as much out of a domestic consideration, and I think it's important to note that the Saudi policy towards Yemen has always been seen as a domestic issue for Saudi Arabia, not a foreign policy issue. When the Saudis decided to move, I think we felt we had no option but to support them. We weren't going to support the Houthi. The Saudis were going to go in anyway. And so if we could provide some intelligence and other assistance, which would at least help focus and tailor what they were doing, we probably calculated that that was in our better interest. It may actually get the Houthi to the table. The question is, will the central government, what's left of it, also go to the table? And will we be able at the end of the day to have a negotiated settlement to this mess? Because it will not be settled militarily.
Well, let me ask Graham Bannerman, do you think that we will eventually have a negotiated settlement to this situation?
I agree fully that the only solution is through a negotiated settlement. But as I was having a conversation with some of the other partners in the Saudis the other day, I said, now who is going to be the negotiators here? Now that you all have put yourself on one side of the table, what country in the region can be seen as a neutral party, or who can come in and be a neutral party to do the negotiations? It's become much more complicated by the military action. Now, do I think it's going to get to that? Yes, because I don't think that any combination of forces is going to dislodge what I will call the Yemeni nationalist from their position. They may lose some territory, they may lose some areas, but on the whole, they will stay firm.
I think it's important to note that of all of the Arab countries who signed up to support the Saudi efforts, Oman did not. And I think part of this is Oman positioning itself to be the good offices. The Omanis have good relations with Iran. President Obama just thanked Oman for their help on these Iranian talks. The Omanis are also part of the GCC, and they're personally very close to the Yemenis. And so I think there is a party there that can host and facilitate when it is time for everyone to get to the table.
I would like to second that, but there's another reason why Oman did not go in. This is a Sunni coalition, and the Omanis are not Sunnis,
and
they're not Shia. So therefore, they are a neutral party in that sense. They have an identity that's their own based on their Abadi history.
Well, you said earlier, Graham Bannerman, that Mansour Hadi was the first Sunni leader to take power after
1,115 years.
Of Zaidi. So how did that come about? We thought he was elected.
He was.
To the extent he was. How was he placed in power after Abdullah Saleh was toppled?
For him to step down, he was vice president, because it was a compromise government where you recognize that Zaidis from the north and the Sunnis from the south. And as Barbara says, the history of southern Yemen was quite different. He was the vice president. It was a compromise agreement. Therefore, when the president steps down, the vice president is the obvious candidate. And if this was midwife by Saudi Arabia, his election by the people, it was El Hadi or no one. That was the choice. And the people endorsed him at that point.
And again, Hadi was the vice president in the central government for an extraordinarily long time. And the identity in Yemen is, first of all, there's a very strong Yemeni identity, but it's to the extent it starts to break down, it breaks down north-south, not Zaidi-Sunni. Mm-hmm. And so Hadi was seen more as the first southerner president of Yemen as opposed to the first Sunni. And that is an extremely important distinction. The referendum on him becoming the interim president as part of the deal for Saleh to step down. It was more of a referendum on the end of the Saleh era. It wasn't cast as a popular democratic vote for a new president. It was a referendum on a transition deal that actually recognized the succession elements of the Yemeni constitution.
Well, we'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Ambassador Barbara Bodine, former U.S. ambassador to Yemen, from whom you just heard. She's currently the director of the Institute for the Study of Diplomacy at Georgetown University. And Graham Bannerman, he's a scholar at the Middle East Institute and founder of Bannerman Associates. That's an international consulting firm. We're talking about the crisis in Yemen and ramifications for regional stability. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA and like us and connect with us on Facebook. You may also send feedback via email to encounter@voanews.com. Either way, tell us where you're from and how you listen to the program. Here's a shout-out to a faithful listener and Facebook fan, Ibuka Orisa from Imo State, Nigeria. Well, back to you again, Ambassador Bodine, to get to the roots of how we got to this place in Yemen. So we now have grievances, primarily by yes. Houthi, and then their grievances weren't being addressed, presumably by President Hadi, or not. Yeah. Okay, so explain, how did we, there were grievances, they were right. on the rise, and then suddenly Hadi is leaving, right. Sana'a, he's going to Aden, yes. he abdicates, they're getting stronger, we're hearing about getting support from Iran, not that Iran necessarily controls them, but somehow Iran sees it in their interest to right. back the Houthi, who are a Shia.
I think it's extremely important to remember that the Houthi rebellion did not start during either President Hadi's term or during the transition. It goes back to at least 2004, when there was a central government headed by President Ali Abdullah Saleh. Their grievances were always a little bit vague. They felt marginalized. They felt that they were not getting the services. It was a very poor country. Almost no one was getting services. But one of their primary grievances was what they saw as a growing presence and influence of Saudi-backed Salafis, particularly in the north, which I think does play to this question as to why the Saudis are involved now. The central government under Saleh, who is now allied with the Houthis, but when he was president, they waged almost an 8-year war against the Houthi. The Houthis, even today, do not enjoy enormous popular support. What happened during the transition is the Houthis actually were part of the political process. They were part of the National Democratic Conference and, in a sense, played inside the political process. But as the transition was moving forward, it was clear that the way that it had been structured is that they were going to have a very hard time getting into the new political structure. And in that, they started pushing for a renegotiation of the GCC agreement. Their ability to take territory is not so much that they have popular support or that they have Iranian support, but it's really that this vacuum had developed in Yemen with a transition government that was there too long, services that were not being provided, and as I said, it was a vacuum. When they came into Sana'a in September, there was virtually no fight. It wasn't a battle.
Exactly.
In fact, negotiated a national partnership plan with the Hadi government and brought in probably the most qualified technocratic cabinet that Yemen has had in a very long time. And so in early fall, it actually looked like, in its own Yemeni way, it was going to work out. They then continue to push. And it's, I think at that point, you had Hadi going under house arrest, the prime minister under house arrest, and the Houthis, I think to most observers, overplayed very badly. When Hadi and the government cabinet stepped down, it was almost as if they were calling the Houthi bluff and saying, you cannot govern. You say you do not want to govern, but you're not letting us govern. So make up your mind. And then at that point, we got into this death spiral that ended up with Hadi finally in Aden. And I think it's because things have moved so quickly that the Saudi military response was as aggressive and also as belated as it was. It just moved too fast.
So, Graham Bannerman, how do you think, we got to this point? And also, could you talk about former President Ali Abdullah Saleh, who, as you both said, fought the Houthi for many years and now is seen as backing them, instigating their rebellion behind the scenes, trying to get back into power in addition to the Iranian support?
I would argue that this has moved well beyond Houthis. in the opposition. I think the opposition now is a coalition of people who have a common interest. And what's surprising to me is how President Hadi has increasingly become isolated within his own country and the minimum support he gets. And I think he's increasingly seen within Yemen as a figurehead for the Saudis. It works against him totally. Mm-hmm. What's also left out of our conversation so far is Yemen also has some extremist Islamic groups, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and not to mention the Muslim Brotherhood. These are forces in Yemen that are the ones who will be most supportive of Saudi Arabia. They have long ties. If you take the Islam Party in Saudi Arabia, they have long ties. So those people are also supporting the operation from inside the country, particularly in the areas not in historical North Yemen. These are areas like the Hadramut, which would not be historically Yemen. It's part of the country. And so therefore, it's very complicated what's going on. What we're talking about here, what Barbara's talking about, is what historically would be Yemen, not some of these added areas. And all of those areas are filled with conflicting tribes, conflicting agendas. That's why you look at Yemen today from the outside, and you just shake your head and say, I don't know how this is ever going to get resolved.
Well, you mentioned Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and so Ambassador Bodine, I mean, this is precisely why the United States was so active in counterterrorism mm-hmm. operations in Yemen.
Right.
But then others say that perhaps the United States placed too much emphasis yes. on counterterrorism, and that maybe that helped to contribute to the situation we're seeing today by not perhaps looking at political and economic development in a more broader way. To what extent mm-hmm. had the United States done that and other Western friends, would we have been in this position today?
I'm one of those people who believes that our policy over the last several years has been too narrowly focused on Al-Qaeda and too narrowly focused on counterterrorism, almost to the exclusion of everything else. We did politically support the national dialogue in the transition. We do provide some economic assistance, but our rhetoric on Yemen is almost exclusively counterterrorism. And by focusing so narrowly both our assistance and our rhetoric, we were not as full partners, and we were not seen by the Yemenis as full partners on the governance and the economic transition. And so in that sense, we did deal ourselves out of this. One of the great ironies, and there's so many in this particular case, is that the group in Yemen that is the most virulently anti-Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and probably has the military ability to seriously confront them are the Houthi. And so if we really wanted to have a partner on Al-Qaeda, we would actually be backing the Houthi.
But we dare not.
But we dare not.
Because of Saudi Arabia.
It gets very complicated. I do agree. I want to, by the way, underscore something that Graham said, that the extent to which Hadi is described consistently as the pro-Saudi president of Yemen, it does diminish him because Yemenis are very nationalistic. But the one group that is probably going to benefit from all of this chaos is going to be Al-Qaeda, because we are not focused on Al-Qaeda and we cannot operate there because we've pulled everybody out. The Houthi can't focus on them because of mm-hmm. fights. The central government is no longer really functioning. And so the Al-Qaeda that sits really in the band in between the Hadramaut and core mm-hmm. Yemen have absolutely nobody putting any pressure on them. And so in terms of counterterrorism policy, we have, by being as narrow as we have been, really helped set up the situation. Could we have completely changed the outcome if we had had a different policy over 10 years? Is counterfactual, and they're very hard. But certainly we have dealt ourselves a very bad hand by the way that we focused on one issue and almost one issue exclusively.
And Graham Bannerman, not only did the United States focus on counterterrorism to the detriment perhaps of other very important issues, now the United States has pulled out. Its embassy, I believe, is closed. All the
yeah.
staff is gone. I mean, and the Saudis are striking Yemen. What about the United States? I mean, did we do the right thing by abandoning Yemen?
I think saying that we abandoned Yemen would be overstated. I mean, there is a problem, as Barbara can tell you. If you're in government and your people are in jeopardy, the State Department clearly, if you listen to the people there, they wanted to stay, they wanted to do their job. But you can't, as a president, leave your people in jeopardy. The military were withdrawn because they no longer were secure in their place. Those are concerns that any government has to take into consideration. But I think the irony is that no matter how this works out, whatever government is going to become finally in charge of Yemen will be allies with us against al-Qaeda, because it's in their interest to be that way. The problem is, we're going through this terrible transition, as Barbara points out, it's a secondary issue for Yemenis, because their survival, their identity, it's all at stake here. Al-Qaeda will be the next issue they get to address, but that gives this great time for al-Qaeda to build its strength.
Which is very dangerous. Well, that leads me to this nuclear deal, Barbara Bodine, the framework of which was struck this week. And of course, we know that the Saudis, along with the Israelis and many of the Gulf states, were fearful of a deal. They're worried about the rise of Iran in the region and, for example, to what extent the talks and the framework deal, to what extent does that reinforce the decision of the Saudis and coalition partners to strike Yemen? Because they're fearful that this framework deal has a potential for upsetting the balance of power between the Saudis and Iran in the region, which is already seen to be going in Iran's favor by virtue of their outsized influence now in Syria and helping to bolster Bashar al-Assad in Iraq, bolstering the Iraqi government to fight the so-called Islamic State, and of course Lebanon, and now of course Yemen.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Iranians, as is often said, not just invented checkers and backgammon, but poker, and they're very good at playing long games. I think the reason that the Iranians went into Yemen to support the Houthis, and again, very, very late in the game, was in part to remind the Saudis, who have been very focused on unseating Assad, who is extremely important to Tehran, reminding the Saudis that we, Iran, can make your southern border very vulnerable, and in a sense to pull Saudi attention away from Syria. And if you kind of look at what the Saudis are doing in Yemen, there is a finite amount of Saudi both political bandwidth and security bandwidth, and right now they're putting it all on Yemen. From an Iranian point of view, this has been a very good gambit. The nuclear deal, and I think the president made a very good case that this was separate from what is going on in the ground on both Syria and ISIL and everything else. I think tellingly, the president also mentioned that he had already talked to the Saudi king before he made the announcement, and that all of the GCC members will be coming to Camp David and later in the spring to talk about broader security cooperation and broader regional issues. The Iranians are not getting a free pass in Syria because of the nuclear deal, and we did not let Syria undermine the nuclear deal.
Well, they're not getting a free pass, but many critics would say the United States and the so-called friends of Syria didn't step up to the plate, irrespective of what was going on in the nuclear negotiations. But nonetheless, back to you, Graham Bannerman, what do you say to critics and some U.S. allies in the region, of course Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states, that this newfound nuclear framework deal could upset them, particularly if there's a financial windfall for Iran as a result of easing of economic sanctions that could enable, in their view, Iran to boost support for its proxy militias in the region, those who are aiding Assad in Syria, the Shia militias in Iraq, and of course now the Houthi in Yemen?
I think there's no doubt that the administration has worked as hard as it can to reassure our allies in the region that our agreement with Iran will not affect our security relationship with them. They've gone out of their way, and they're going out of their way to do that. Unfortunately, nobody in the region's buying it. They basically think it's a zero-sum game. And therefore, if our relationship improves with Iran, somehow it diminishes their security relationship with us. And that's the turn the Saudis have done here. The turn to Yemen is because they see it in the Iranian-Arab context. They have to do this because it's a struggle. Personally, I think it's a mistake. I think they would be wiser if they tried to drive a wedge between the non-Ithna Asharia Shias and the others. What I mean is, you can separate the Zaydis from those guys. They're different. Treat them as Yemenis. Don't treat them as Zaydis. Don't treat them as Shia. And separate them from Iran. But their approach forces them to go into closer cooperation with Iran than they want. You're creating the worst situation possible for yourself. We made the same mistake in the Cold War. In the 1950s, everybody was a communist was bad. But we learned that you can pull away Yugoslavia and the Chinese from the Soviet orbit. I would hope that the Saudis would learn how to do that with the Iranians.
All right. Well, on that note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guest, Ambassador Barbara Bodine, former U.S. ambassador to Yemen, currently the director of the Institute for the Study of Diplomacy at Georgetown University, and Graham Bannerman. He's a scholar at the Middle East Institute. Thanks to both of you for your terrific insights. Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Marty Curcius. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.